Okay, so tonight we have a very special speaker. She is involved in AA in pretty much every aspect. She plays a mom, a parole officer, probation officer, guidance counselor to the ones that she works with that out of the homeless out of Fresno. Tonight, with 11 years out of Fresno, we have Jen C.
Hey everybody, I'm Jen C. I'm an alcoholic. You guys are such a happy crowd tonight. I'm so excited for everybody that's here. Congratulations to all the chip takers. If you're here and you're new or you're fairly new or you're considering maybe whether or not you want to stay, this is your lucky day or it's your lucky year to get sober. At least that was my experience when I got back to AA. It turned like I thought it was the worst day ever, and it turned out to be the best day ever. So my sobriety date is September 15th of 2007, 11 years sober. Thank you. As not my first time around, I'm like to call it a three times a charmer. I tried to get sober in 2004. I went to let me start from the beginning, where I grew up. So I was born, and my parents were not alcoholics or drug addicts. I have one of those stories. What I like about Alcoholics Anonymous is when I hear people give their little pitch in Alcoholics Anonymous at speaker meetings, they're always so different, you know. And it's been my experience that people like me without alcoholic parents or not drug addict parents or not surrounded by that environment can still grow up and be an alcoholic. And then I hear other people that grew up in some terrible conditions with a lot of things going on, and I've heard them tell their story, and they get sober too. So Alcoholics Anonymous works for all of us that want to come in and work this program. So they were not alcoholics, drug addicts. What I found out later is that I have two alcoholic grandfathers. So it runs in my genes. I'm predisposed, I guess. And what I know also now is that, like, as a kid, I always felt kind of out of place. And it wasn't because my parents didn't love me or they left me out of things, but I could very easily, on a Friday night when it was movie night, sit in the corner and be like, my parents don't like me, as my brother sat on the couch with them, you know, and with the dogs, and I, like, exclude myself on purpose. Today I feel like that's just a characteristic of my alcoholism, you know. My alcoholism likes me separate and different and alone so that it can take advantage and try to kill me. So growing up, I'm from a traditional Hispanic family, which means there's a lot of beer kegs at all of our events. If it's like a birthday party, it was two beer kegs, wedding, three beer kegs, funerals, four or more. And I had this uncle, I remember him very specifically because he was super grumpy and he was mean and he'd sit at the kitchen table and smoke cigarettes with a disgusted look on his face. And I would see that man at these parties or wherever we were, family reunion, stand by that beer keg, and he would be laughing, and he would be playing a five-string guitar that should have six, singing Spanish music, and he was just joyful. And I knew there was magic in the beer keg right then. So it became my mission really early. I think I was 12 the first time I snuck some beer out of the keg into a red cup. And I immediately got busted by one of my aunts. She told on me, and then, you know, that was over. But I've been trying to alter my state of mind since as early as I can remember. And mostly just because I feel uncomfortable in the world and I didn't get, like, the manual on life and how to do it. So, you know, I was an athlete. I played Little League baseball with boys from 6 to 12, which made me, like, a tomboy, what they call them. So that made me different too, you know. And I learned to communicate from those boys, and then I had to switch over to girls softball junior high because back then that's just what you did. And when you hit puberty, the boys get a lot stronger than the girls. So that happened, and then I had to adjust to this girls softball stuff. And in school, sports kept my grades good, you know. They kept me so that I would perform in school so that I could play sports. And, you know, I can think back to as a kid how I had a real difficult time dealing with emotions of any kind. And I had two feelings by high school, and they were happy and angry. And that's it. Nothing in between. And then when I was 16, like, the event happened. I went to a softball tournament in Bakersfield, And when I was there, my dad went to work on his day off, and he was in an accident. He was killed in an accident at work. And I was 16 years old, and my mom had lost her soulmate, and my little brother was 11. And I, you know, like, what do you even do with that kind of... And we had, like, that all-American family, you know, like, Monopoly after dinner kind of thing. And I was so angry at God, or what I knew at that point was that if there was a God, he didn't care about me or my family. That's what I thought I knew. So that happened, and that became my excuse, I realized, for many years after that to drink and use the way that I did. And the truth is that I was experimenting way before that happened. Like, my first drink, unattended, like with no parents to hide from and no friends to be like, no, drink it like this so you don't get sick. I was 14 when that happened, so my dad was still around. And I drank Canadian whiskey in a strawberry soda. I was babysitting, and the kid went to sleep, you know. And so I was like, this will be good. It'll be okay. And I drank as much as I thought I should drink. And I, like, you know, and I felt, like, really calm and relaxed, and, like, everything was all right in the world. And people came home. I got my money. I walked down the street. It was my neighbors. And I sat down, and I was watching Beverly Hills 90210 in front of the TV. And the room started spinning. And my parents were on the couch behind me, and my brother was sitting next to me, and I crawled out of the living room, down the hallway into the bathroom, locked the door, fell, hit my head on the toilet, and woke up the next day with puke on my shirt. So that was like my first unattended session with alcohol. So I've been doing it like that for a long time, right? But anyways, after that happened, what I did after my dad passed away was try to like be in charge of the family. And it was a lot of pressure, and I just had to drink more. I had to drink more, and I started getting into relationships with people who drank worse than me so I wouldn't have to look at my own drinking. I did that a lot in my early 20s especially. At one point, I remember about 23 years old, making a New Year's resolution to quit drinking because she was crazy when we drank, and I didn't want to deal with that anymore. And I can remember, the Big Book talks about there are a lot of young people who could stop drinking, maybe, but they probably won't want to, you know, for any length of time. I was like that. At 23, I stopped drinking in January 1st, and I was able to not drink for about 8 months. And I didn't go to AA. I just was like, oh, I totally can do this. You know, that relationship ended because alcoholism. And when I got back to Fresno from Sacramento where I was living, I was like, I got to catch up for the last 8 months. You know, so from 23 to 27, I drank. It was like a downward spiral for me. The other thing that happened at 23, 24 years old was I decided I wasn't a drug addict and I wasn't going to touch anything illegal anymore. So when that happened, what I realized today is it was like this switch, you know, from one thing to the other, because I will take anything to change the way that I feel. You know, and when I cut out all the other stuff, especially the stuff that can make me drink longer for all night and not have to wake up and have a hangover and that kind of thing, like when I stopped doing that, my drinking just progressed immensely. So by 27, I was like a daily vodka drinker, all day, every day. And that's just how I lived. And I worked and I drove, and I was an assistant manager at a Taco Bell. And we ran out of beans on a Thursday night. I was working for my best friend's wife. And because I got fired from my last job because I was a drunk. But they didn't say, because you're drunk. They said something else, but that's why. And it was a Thursday night, and we ran out of beans. And I had a total meltdown at work. And I called my boss, and I was like, I need to go to rehab. I'm an alcoholic. Because I forgot that I could go down the street to the other Taco Bell and just borrow beans. So it was the end of my rope. I was at the end of my rope there. And I went to an inpatient detox for my first time, and then I did that for 5 days. And at this inpatient detox, they had, like, this nurse who would come and take you to draw pictures, and another nurse who would come and take you to walk on the treadmill, and then another lady who would come and take you to the really good cafeteria and the really good food. I did that, I think it was 5 days I was in there, and then they sent me to an outpatient program afterwards. And that was my first experience with, like, them saying, you need to go to AA, and you need to work the steps, and here's the program, and we're going to do all this work at the outpatient, but you need to go do this too. So I got my first taste of AA. They said to get a sponsor, preferably one of your own gender, so I got a man because in the relationship that I was in, wouldn't allow for that, like me spending time with some other female. So I got a guy, and I took very little suggestions from him. I worked steps 1, 2, 3, and 12 the first time around. And I say that because if you're new at this and you're going to try to go 1, 2, 3, and 12, I don't recommend it. I was not happy, joyous, and free during that time. And the truth is that I hadn't learned any of the things about myself that you learn in steps 4 through 11. So my behavior couldn't change. Like, I had no knowledge of, like, my behavior, my patterns, and the things that I like to do, even without a drink. And I started acting in ways, after I got my one-year chip, I started lying and cheating and just doing things to generally destroy my life. And eventually, by 4 days shy of 17 months, I had to pick up a drink. Because I had decided that it was okay to sleep with an employee while I was in a relationship, while I was, lie to my boss, lie to my girlfriend at the time, and just lie all the way around and cheat and sneak around. And I didn't know that that was going to make me drink. As a matter of fact, I said to myself many times, I'm not going to drink over this, because I just knew that wouldn't happen, right? Because I have this knowledge that I'm an alcoholic, and drinking is not an option. How many people have heard that before? Drinking is not an option, right? And I really meant it when I said that, you guys. But what I had done was that person that I was messing around with, I've destroyed my relationship, so that was over. And then I threw a 21st birthday party in my backyard for this girl who, with all this alcohol. And it was a bad idea. And during the party, I was like, no, I don't drink. No, I don't drink. No, it's okay. No, you guys go ahead and beer bong the thing, and you guys have fun. And the whole night, I didn't want to drink. And the next day, I woke up, and I looked around my house, and there was just alcohol everywhere. And it was just me and, like, a keg and a bunch of bottles. And I remember thinking, like, I should call my sponsor, but I hadn't talked to him in several months. And so I was like, I know, I'll pray for God to make me into a normal drinker, because God is omnipotent, and he can do it. So I prayed on my knees for God to make me into a normal drinker, and then I mixed. Well, here's what happened, was there was grapefruit vodka on the counter, and it was new. I had never had grapefruit vodka. I was right next to some squirt, so it was a perfect mix. So I mixed the drink, and I took that drink, and my belly warmed up. And immediately, you guys, I was like, I am not an alcoholic. That was so overreacting. I didn't need rehab. I didn't need AA. Those people don't even care about me anyways. And then I drank, like, I don't know how many more drinks and passed out in my living room. So God did not make me into a normal drinker. And shortly after that, I, like, drank for, I think, 2 weeks straight and ended up in a inpatient detox again because I didn't want to lose my job. I had missed several days of work, and they were like, you got to do something. And I went to a different one, one for people that don't have insurance, like the insurance I had the first time. And it was 3 days, I think, that time. And there was no nurse to take me to draw pictures. And there was no nurse to take me to walk on a treadmill. And the food sucked. So that happened. And I was like, I swear I'm never drinking again. If I just get out of here, get 30 days so I don't have to announce myself as a newcomer at a meeting. And then I'll go back to AA and I'll do all the things. Well, 45 days later, I was drunk again. I never made it back to AA. And I stayed out for about a year and a half. And during that year and a half, I tried all the things he read in that chapter 3 to, like, not have to live the way I was living. It was hell out there, having all that knowledge of AA and then having to drink every day still. And I was in that same relationship that I had destroyed before. She'd come back because I was drinking again, so it worked out. I was just trying all those things and trying all those things, and no matter what I did, I couldn't drink the AA away. And I remember taking up projects. I took up projects around the house because if I was doing stuff, then she didn't bother me that I was drinking. And there was a liquor store and there was a hardware store next to each other in Fresno, right next door. So I'd, like, go to get the thing I needed for the project, and then I'd come home and I'd be drunk, and then I'd forget something, of course. I have to go back, like, 4 times in a day. And I remember mowing the lawn and hitting a sprinkler head and causing a flood and the lawnmower flipping upside down and me falling off the curb, standing up and going, your hats are off to me, to the whole neighborhood, but there was nobody there. But it's what he read earlier. If you could do an about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to you. And I just still couldn't get it out of my mind. And I was not drinking like a gentleman. So this went on, right? And I was with this really good codependent partner. And she's like, we're going to have babies. And I was like, okay, what do I have to do? So we got licensed. Babies cure everything, you guys. What I know today is that alcoholism doesn't care how much I love my babies. And alcoholism doesn't care how much I love my mom or my brother or the people that love me that are pleading for me to stop destroying myself and everything around me. It doesn't care. But so anyways, I got licensed as a risk adopt home in Fresno County. And they're going to give me babies. I'm drinking 4 pints of vodka a day. And so one day it happens, you know, they're like, hey, come pick up this kid. And I'm, you know, it's the middle of the day. I'm driving around. I'm like, okay. And she drives. So she drives the baby that time. But I go and I pick up this little 3-day-old baby from community hospital in Fresno. And I look at him and I'm like, I have to stop drinking in my mind, not out loud to the nurses. And I want it so bad. Like, I want it so bad right then. Because I know I'll never be a parent the way my parents were to me if I continue to drink. Because I can't take care of myself. I'm a mess, you know. And all I can do is what I've been doing. And I had sworn off AA, so I couldn't crawl back in there. But, like, I really wanted to get sober. I really did. And he was 3 days old. He was born August 15th. I picked him up on the 18th. And for the next 27 days, every day before I'd open my eyes, I would say, I'm not going to drink today. And every day I'd get in my car to go to work, and my car would drive to the liquor store. Every day. And I couldn't make it stop. And 6:30 in the morning on a Friday, September 14th of 2007, I walked back into a meeting at Sierra Fellowship in Clovis. And I don't know what happened that day, but I could hear the ladies. I was the newcomer in the back of the room crying. I see you guys. And I was there and I could hear them say, like, you don't have to feel this way anymore if you don't want to. You never have to drink again if you work this program. Here's our phone numbers, call us. And like, I had this like hope for a moment that I didn't have to live that way anymore. And it was a surprise to me. Because I was like, I've done AA, it doesn't work. But the truth is, I skipped all the steps in between. So that day I tried to go to work. And I was like, I'm going to go to work. And then I'm going to take the weekend to detox. And then I'll just go on a roll and go back to meetings and not have to do the whole whatever. But by noon that day, I was like, I have this emotional, psychological, physical reaction to the idea of not drinking anymore. And I could not get through the day at work. And at some point, I decided it was a good idea to go into my boss's office and tell him I was an alcoholic. And I was drunk, so that's where my great ideas come from. And so I go in and I say that, and he goes to my office. He takes my keys, my wallet, and my phone off the desk. And then he gets on the phone, and I change my mind. I'm like, nope, never mind, I'll find a new job. Well, he's like, sit down, and he has all my stuff, so I can't go anywhere. That day was like a long, drawn-out thing, and they took me to the hospital, and they took me to places, and I blew a .29, and I think I'd only drank about a quarter of what I would usually drink on a regular day. And so they made me go to treatment, which was fine, but I was going to get back in AA, so like I just did what I said. I had this therapist at the time. This is like my re-entry into AA and 12 steps, you know. And I had this therapist, and she had this PhD, and she was really smart, and she had been in recovery for a lot of years, and she talked, she moved her hands a lot when she talked. She gesticulates all over, and she's like, I'm going to give you the answer right now. And I was like, she's going to give me the answer. And she goes, shut the F up and do what you're told. And I was like, that's your PhD answer? I didn't like it. But the truth was that so that list of phone numbers they gave, I called some people off that list. I found a girl who was walking around with her big book 24/7. And I'd call her every day and she'd be like, well, the big book says blah, 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 blah. And then I'd have another problem and I'd call her, well, the big book says on page blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay. I was certain she couldn't hear my problems, but she had something that I wanted, you know, and I started listening to the things that she said, And in that first year of sobriety, all the things that I thought that I was getting sober for were threatened. By the time I was 5 months sober, I found out that my partner was cheating, and she was going to leave, and she was going to take this kid that I was getting sober for, you know? Or that was what the plan was. That was her plan. And there's just all the emotions that come with that, like rejection, and like I'm not going to be able to be a parent, and just all the stuff. And we were still living together for a while after the breakup, which was terrible, and I was just like on the verge, you know? But every time I got to that place where I was like, I'm just going to drink, you know, 6 months sober, 7 months sober, 8 months sober. And I'd call my sponsor and I'd be like, this is happening and this is happening. And she's like, well, you need to read page 69 through 71. You need to write a pros and cons list about this relationship. And you need to come with us to speak at West Care panel on H9 panel tonight. And I was like, my alcoholic mind is like, I need to stalk the phone records, find out how long this has been going on. I need to beat this other person who's been ruining my family, and I need to abduct my son and run to Mexico. And I would tell her that, and she'd say things to me very often in the first year, like, Jen, we don't commit homicide in sobriety. Jen, we don't commit kidnapping in sobriety. Jen, we don't throat punch people in sobriety. Really simple, right? But I can't think of that. So I would do the things that she told me to do, like go to the West Care panel with the H&I people and share my experience, strength, and hope. And every time I did that, it would be one more day I didn't have to drink, and I could do the things that I needed to do to stay sober so I could have that boy in my life. By the time he was about a year old, it was like getting close to that adoption moment, and I remember her calling and saying, hey, we're going to lie to CPS and say we're together and adopt him together. How's that for you? And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. One, we don't get along at all. Two, I'm not supposed to lie in sobriety. And, you know, it was an overall bad idea. And she kept pushing for that. And what ended up happening was I called CPS and said, hey, here's what's going on. I, like, told the truth. Like, laid myself out there. What should I do? And they said, because I was in the licensed home, that's a thing, so I stayed in the licensed home. And they said, you decide what happens next. And I was like, what? So what happened was we broke up. We tried to do co-parenting. It didn't work out. It was too tumultuous, and that's no good for a baby. And he was still a ward of the court, so we made a decision to just part ways, and that little boy was adopted by just me. That kid is my heart, and he has not had to see me drink like that ever, you know, and he's an amazing kid. He was more mature than me and more considerate by the time he was three, but I was three too, to be fair, 3 years sober, you know. And then my mom is a really good grandma, you know, so she helped me a lot. When I was working at night, and she works during the day as a teacher, and we'd switch off at like 5 p.m. And when that boy was 17 months old, the social worker said, hey, he's got a little brother. Do you want him? And they gave me two babies. I had him and his brother. They brought his brother. I held that little baby in my arms. He was 3 weeks old when he came. And I went, this kid looks just like me. Couldn't have made a kid look more like me than this kid. And so I have a 9 and 11-year-old. They're this big. And both adopted just me, you know. And I had some tumultuous relationships early in sobriety. I like to, because, okay, so I'm an alcoholic, right? And I'm working the steps. So I had worked the steps with my sponsor. I got through, I think step 5 by 5 months, right before all this stuff hit the fan, you know. And so I knew a lot of my patterns, and like I'm working the steps, and I'm trying to be good, and I'm trying to live by spiritual principles. And, you know, sobriety is not for weenies, you guys. It's really hard. And my point about that was, like, I'm trying to do all these things, but I'm still an alcoholic, and I'm still addicted to chaos and all the drama that used to surround me when I was drinking and doing what I do. You know, so I would get into, like, a crazy relationship, and then it would be a roller coaster ride. And then it would be, you know, by the grace of God, I'm sober, you guys. And the steps and good sponsorship and always being in service. That's like one of the biggest things that my sponsor, that first sponsor, every time I would call crying and complaining, like, I need to go help another alcoholic. And, you know, and he read it at the beginning of this meeting about, it's the first line of chapter 7, that practical experience shows us that nothing will so ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. And it has been my experience that that is the truth. And it works when other activities fail. You know, I was, through all of my drama in my first few years of sobriety, I was in the middle of the pack in AA. You know, I had sponsor, and I was surrounded first by, like, sobriety sisters. And if ever there was a problem that, you know, when that breakup happened that first year, I was like a toddler flailing around, you know, and they would pick me up and they would walk me to the next meeting. And I'd do the service because the therapist said, shut up and do what you're told. You know, and I was just, and they just kept picking me up and walking and loving me, you know, and they just kept loving me. And God was really gentle with me as far as relationships go, because, yeah, I had a few crazy ones, but, like, slowly I figured out, like, I need to love myself, and I need to be sober for me, and I need to be a good parent to these kids. Like, all those things I learned through the step work, and eventually through working with other alcoholics. And when those things would happen, those bad things would happen, you would find me on the back patio with a sponsee by the time I was 2 years sober, you know? Or I think it was 18 months. I was complaining at 18 months. Nobody wants what I have. Nobody's asked me to sponsor them. I don't know what's wrong. And then I got 4 people in 1 week asked me to sponsor them. I never have said that again. But the truth is that, like, I was told to say yes. And I continue to say yes, because if 4 people ask me to sponsor them in a week, I can pretty much guarantee that at the end of 30 days or 60 days, there'll be 1 left maybe, because they figure out that I'm going to ask them to do all these things that they don't really want to do, and, you know, they just kind of disappear. And this is a serious disease. You know, I know today that I have alcoholism, and they describe alcoholism as a fatal and progressive disease. It means it's always going to get worse, and eventually I'm going to die from it. And I don't like that. So I continue to stay in the middle of the pack in AA. You know, I look at pictures from 5 years ago, or 4, 5, 6 years ago, and it's like me and my sponsor and like 4 of my sobriety sisters. And I was looking at pictures from last year, and it's me and my wife and 8 of our sponsees, you know. This sobriety family, and it's like impossible for me to drink because I'm surrounded by you guys. At 4 years sober, when I had given up on relationships, I was like, I'm going on restriction, I'm not having coffee with anybody, no lunch, no flirting. And then my sponsor was like, that's great, when you're done, I know the perfect girl for you. And she's my wife today. And I tried to do all the things different in that relationship. I tried to, like, not move too fast. Tried to wait a whole year before I let her move in with me. It lasted 10 months. It's progress, not perfection. I waited 2 years before I asked her to marry me, which before it always been like 2 months. And then we were engaged for another 2 years before we got married. So, and that relationship is, you know, relationships are a lot of work. But the positive thing is that, like, we share this program together. And we understand the struggle. And, like, when one of us needs to, like, go do what we need to do to stay sober for a day, like, we go do that. You know, there's no, like, oh, you're going to another one of those meetings? Like, I guess could happen if you're with someone who's not in the program. I don't know. That wasn't my experience. But it's a really good life, you know. And if it hadn't been for that girl, that girl that sponsored me that first 3 years, she's not even in meetings anymore. It's like she appeared for that first 3 years to save my life, and now she's not around. And I still try to reach out to her, but she's moved away. And, you know, that's just been my experience. That, like, we meet during these times, and, like, you have an opportunity. If you're sitting here in this room sober, you have an opportunity for a brand new life. It can change dramatically, because that was my experience. Like, I was a fall down, piss my pants, shitty drunk. Like, I was just a loser. I was the piece of crap that ex used to call me, the one who was going to take that baby from me, and I am not that person today. Today, I get to walk around with my head up, you know? I'm not afraid of seeing anybody in the grocery store. I go to work. I'm a good spouse. I'm a good parent. I'm a good friend. I'm a good daughter to my mom again, you know? And I learned a lot of my lessons later in sobriety as I work with newbies, because I see, like, what they put their families through, you know? Nobody has taught me more about how horrible it was for my mother to watch me go through what I was going through than a new sponsee who can't get sober and their mom's calling me like, oh, she's drunk again, you know, like, it's just, it's a serious disease. And, you know, and I see newcomers want it so bad. And I was telling somebody just today, like, it might not even be for the person who wants it. This program is a program for the people who do it. You have to do it. It's a program of action, you know. And I got to work through all those steps. I got to learn all about myself in that fourth and fifth step. I got to, like, agree with God that I let him take all my character defects in the sixth and seventh step. And then know that I'm going to have shortcomings and, like, try to come back from those. Not just have to, like, be like, I can never speak to you again because you saw me act stupid. You know, that eighth and ninth step were freedom, you know, because I got to make amends to the people who would allow me to do that. And I had some really good experiences at that. I saw people's lives change because I could look at them and say, hey, I did this and I was wrong and I won't do it again and I'm different, you know. And they had life-changing experiences and I got to watch that. 10, 11, and 12 is where I live today, step 10, 11, and 12, you know. Every night I review my day. And if I'm doing something stupid, I call my sponsor and tell her about it. And maybe I'm not even willing to change my behavior yet, but at least I know what I'm doing wrong, and, like, I have an opportunity to pray for the willingness to be willing to change. You know? Most of the time she's like, stop doing that. And I'm like, okay. And step 11 is starts my day, you know? Asking God in the morning to help me be kind and to help me be tolerant and to help me get through my day without throat punching someone. I work in a stressful job. He was talking about all of my roles at work. I'm a case manager for permanent supportive housing in the county of Fresno. So I work with chronically homeless and documented disabled. They're both. Most of them are drug addicts and alcoholics. That's why they've been on the street for over a year. You know? So I get to see that every day. Like, part of my job includes smashing meth pipes on a regular basis. And it's hard. It's hard work. But, you know, I leave that at work. But I have the opportunity to, like, know, have been there and know. Like, hey, and I can tell them, because most of them are pretty cool. Like, hey, there's a solution. And if you want it, let me know. And I've had a couple of clients that be like, will you take me to a meeting? And I get to do that. I have the luxury of getting to do that at work. I can take them to the grocery store. I can take them to a meeting. It's up to me, you know. And so I'm in a position where I think God has probably placed me to be of maximum service to him and my fellows, like it says is our job in the big book, you know. And when I got here, you guys, I wasn't looking for a relationship with God because, like I told you, I was pretty sure God didn't care about me, you know. And even as I started working those steps with a sponsor, it wasn't so I could find God. It was so I could stop peeing in my pants. It's so I could stop waking up or coming to on a Wednesday night at 7 p.m. in my nice work clothes with one shoe off and my car door still open and being like, what happened? I came here to not do that anymore. I didn't come here to build this relationship with a higher power. And as a result of working the steps with a sponsor, I found a higher power of my understanding that I can go to on a regular basis that gives me the strength and the courage and the power to, like, carry out his will every day. You know, in the second step talks about living life on spiritual principles. And then what it says is we have to do that. We have to live life based on spiritual principles. Or be doomed to an alcoholic death. Like, those are the choices. Doomed to an alcoholic death, spiritual principles. I have to keep it really simple like that for me sometimes. Like, should I do this thing? Is it right or is it wrong? You know, if it's spiritual principles, that means it's the right thing to do. And sometimes it's so hard because it's so boring to do the right thing all the time. You know? So maybe I make some choices that are doomed to an alcoholic death choices. The problem is, you guys, is that I don't know how many of those choices I can make before I pick up a drink. Like, that scale could tip, and I could be back out there. So I work really hard, and that's why I say living in 10, 11, and 12. I work really hard with my sponsor still to make sure that I keep that scale in balance, you know. There was a time about 3 years sober, I called that sponsor, that first sponsor. I'm like, you know, I don't really know if I'm built for life based on spiritual principles. And she goes, oh, okay, are you built for a life doomed to an alcoholic death? And I was like, I've seen it, you guys. I've buried my friends in this program. I had two friends that went back out after 7 years. 7 years sober, they went back out. Other substances took them out. Eventually, they drank again, though. And both of them died of this disease. And we got to bury them. It's a horrible, progressive, fatal disease. It's not a joke, you know. There's a lot of laughing in the rooms of AA because we're not a glum lot, but when I think about them, I think, you know, what happens when that happens to my friends is it makes me work harder in AA. That week, that last friend that passed away that had such an impact on me, I was in a meeting every day that week. And I met one of my sponsees at one of those meetings. And I just happened to be there because I was upset because my friend was gone, you know. And then we get to meet. And then you get an opportunity to help somebody new. And they can, you guys get to decide your level of involvement in this thing we call AA, which I think is awesome. But it's unfortunate that we don't, like, hammer in the suggestions a little harder. But we can't, right? You have to let people take the suggestions they want to. And but I want everybody to get to have this. I want everybody to get to have sobriety the way that I've gotten to have it. I want everybody to get to be happy, joyous, and free. My life on a regular basis is full of, like, my kids are happy, and we're doing fun stuff. We're, like, hiking in the sequoias, and, you know, I'm watching their cross-country meets, and we're selling candy so they can go to SOS, Sierra, whatever thing up there. You know, it's just, it's a lot of fun. And all the work is totally worth it for everything that I get to have in this program. And like I said, I'm just engulfed in program. Like, I'm surrounded by you guys. It would be a bad idea. Like, I wouldn't even probably think to drink because it would be just like, well, I have, you know, all these sponsees and my sponsor is going to be, I'm just surrounded by you. And they talk about, you know, being in the middle of the pack. And that's where I stayed. And it's where I need to stay if I'm going to continue to do this thing for the next 11 years. And that's my goal. Because the idea of going back out and having to live in that hell that I was living in is not the business, and I don't want to do it. So I continue to stay in the middle of the pack. If you're on the outskirts, get in the middle. Because the gazelles on the outskirts get eaten by the lion first. That's what they told me. I want to thank Bill for asking me to come out here and do this. I want to congratulate all of you again for being here and get a sponsor worth the steps. That's all.
Let's give Jen another round of applause.